This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of diversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
Today we have a very special episode of This Just In, not only because it's the form in which I am now formally announcing that issue 2 is in the bag, I repeat, issue 2 is in the bag, but because it honors a very special fan who has recently departed this earthly realm. Steve Irwin, known to the public as the Crocodile Hunter, was an avid listener of our podcast and was in direct correspondence with both Tanner and myself straight up until his tragic death this past weekend. If you haven't heard, Steve was stabbed through the heart by a stingray and could not be saved. So first and foremost, Steve, Tanner and I are both consuming beers in your honor. And, again, in your honor, this song is for you. Hit it, Tanner.
Now I see why the song fits. That's all the Stingray is really trying to do, you know?
That's right, he was kickstarting Steve's heart.
Yeah, and I'm drinking Foster's. Specifically
I'm drinking Sam Adams Boston Lager.
Specifically in honor of Steve Irwin, I bought this Foster's. You know, this is also a great Labor Day song, because there's no other song that just sums up the working man's life, you know? When I think of this song, I think of, like, roofers, you know, on their lunch break or whatever, with a cassette deck.
With a hot girl walking by the job site.
Yeah.
Obviously, the correlation is Steve's heart stopped. And he needs a kickstart. It's too late, probably. His corpse is in the ground. But let me get back to Steve, because in one letter addressed to both Tanner and myself, Steve actually remarked to you, "Crikey, I can't get enough of your podcasts. You were absolutely correct in stating that the ocean is where we should be going and not outer space. Two more reasons why you guys are spot on. There are no crocs in space, and two, if there are reptilian aliens, they're going to be mighty mad we've enslaved their brethren." Typical Steve, he's always the jokester. I'll never forget the first email received from him. He had just recently souped up Croc 1, his state-of-the-art mobile research station, which he had just put Wi-Fi in, and he sent us his very first transmission saying, "I listen to you guys while wrangling snakes and playing with koala bears. I'd much rather take my chances with them than either of your guys' logic and wit. You're too quick for me." So, in honor of Steve, we're dedicating this episode to him by talking about a few of the topics that he held dear to him. The first being in American schools versus teaching safe sex. Steve was big on making sure people knew how to keep safe during sex, so we'll be discussing a document written back in 2004 by Representative Henry Waxman in California called The Content of Federally Funded Abstinence-Only Programs, which is sure to infuriate most listeners, and that will most likely segue into a discussion of gender roles in America. Now, Steve was also in Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution, two popular games for the PS2, so much so that just before his untimely death, he actually removed the crocodile exhibit from his zoo and replaced it with a DDR dance floor where he and 12 animal wranglers performed a two-hour set to songs like We Didn't Start the Fire and the Ghostbusters theme. Tanner's just recently gotten into Guitar Hero at Steve's posthumous request, and will give us a full rundown on that game. And finally, I'm formally announcing that the weblog is back and on the attack, and once again, we need to credit the Croc Hunter for lighting a fire under our asses and getting us back on task. As for your host, I'm Chris View, podcasting from Detroit.
And I'm Tanner Higgin, podcasting from Los Angeles. Now, I have something to say about the Croc Hunter.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
He's responsible for one of the best moments of TV I've ever seen in my life. And probably midway in his career, he had this friend, and anyone who watched The Croc Hunter probably knows of this guy. He was like a blonde-haired surfer-looking dude.
Manny?
No, it wasn't Manny. It was like his friend from the Australian Zoo. I can't remember his name, but they were like best buds. And there was this great episode where it was like storming at the Australian Zoo, and they had to like move some crocs or something like this. There was some crisis. It was storming. It was crazy. And they had to move crocs from cages and shit. So his friend is like scaling this fence and goes in to like wrangle the croc, and he gets fucking bit by the croc.
Whoa.
During the storm, and Steve Irwin, without even thinking, just launches himself over the fence and tackles the croc and restrains the fucking crocodile to save his friend's life. And it was,
whoa,
it was like some of the best reality TV to date that I've ever seen, because it was so absolutely real. And like, it showed that, you know, Steve Irwin could easily be seen as some sort of big, you know, joke. Like, he doesn't back up what he does. But in that moment, you really saw that he means fucking business, and he knew what he was doing. And it's, you know, it's sad that he's dead, but it's kind of cool that he went out battling an animal in some way, you know?
I don't know if you battle a stingray. Stingrays aren't, like, aggressive creatures. He was, according to reports anyway, you know, a stingray will only react to the situation it's frightened in. And so yeah, what happened was Steve was probably trying to pet it or give it some food or whatever. The stingray perceived Steve to be some sort of a threat and then pierced his heart with his tail. They stated that the poison wouldn't have killed Steve because the poison in stingrays just isn't enough to kill your average. No, Steve is beyond average. He's a god amongst men. And so that stingray, the tail pierced his heart, and I guess it probably tore like a hole in his heart that was too large for him to come back from.
I petted stingrays at the San Diego or Long Beach Aquarium, and they seem real docile.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, their tail just seems like a flimsy piece of flesh. It's amazing to think of that tail somehow piercing, because the way I understand it is it went into his body.
It went through his sternum, as far as I know, because it touched his heart.
That is amazing.
Yeah, the thing touched his heart.
That is unbelievable that those things are capable of that.
Yeah, let me see. I know I saw a story that said, let's see, when frighteners stepped on vicious-looking spines up to 25 centimeters long with bread knife-like serrations are deployed as a defense mechanism. So, up to 25 centimeters long, it's still not that huge, I guess, but
He must have messed with some fucking super stingray.
What if it was that, like, he had stumbled upon the world's largest stingray? Like, this thing was a gigantor stingray.
Well, you know what should have happened is fucking Animal Planet should have gotten behind this and woven a brilliant PR story. You know, that made him into some superhero.
I think it was caught on tape.
Oh, my God.
There's a thing that's, I can't access the site when I go to the Google News link, when I type in Crocodile Hunter and go to news, the first thing up says, footage shows Australia's Crocodile Hunter Steve Irwin's death, but I can't, and it says on the subheadline, Steve Irwin was videotaped pulling a poisonous stingray barb from his chest moments before losing consciousness forever.
Oh my God.
So that's,
I need to see that video.
Yeah.
YouTube.
Yes, YouTube. Like, immediately, one of the crew is like, I gotta get this on YouTube. I almost hope it's not up there right yet. I'm not ready for
it. It doesn't look like
too
it.
Too big of a contributor to this show for me to want to see his death.
No, it's not up there. It doesn't look like
nothing
it.
There. Well, then let's move on, because
All right. We
know Steve was a great guy, but let's talk about something he reinvigorated with us, which is the weblog. Tell everyone what's going on with that, Tanner.
It died quite a while ago because we overburdened ourselves with work, and there was really no way to keep up with running a hit literary journal, running a hit podcast, and pumping out article-sized contributions to a blog once a week. So it sort of just died, but now I think we're going to resurrect it, and in a different sort of form, where it's just going to be small posts with comments capable, so you can log in. Well, you have to register, log in, and then you can post comments, and they're just going to be short posts, hopefully more frequent. And I'm also thinking the posts will probably sort of interact with the podcast. So, you know, I'd encourage everyone to start looking there again, register so you can comment, and then we can involve your comments in the show too if the blog and the podcast start to interact and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of a slippery slope that I'm afraid of, because we had at one time, in one of our former literary endeavors, we had enabled comments on our website, and it led way to really poor comments. In other words, people would make comments that they became these armchair generals. They became somehow, you know, the smartest people on the internet, and other people who were commenting were dumb for whatever they had to say. And one thing I'd like to say is this is an open forum, and nobody's better than anyone else on this. The only two people who are better than anyone is Tanner and I, because we have ultimate authority. So when it comes to the commenting, try to be constructive and stimulate conversation. Don't try to be obstructive and just make yourself look like you're God and everyone else is a douchebag. Because otherwise it just ruins the environment which we're trying to create with this magazine as well. So, anyway, it's my two cents on that. I hate to sound like I'm some sort of, like, you know, lecturing to junior high schoolers, but sadly, when you're dealing with the internet, a lot of times people become in that mindset of junior high school when they're playing on stuff. So, anyway. So that was a buzzkill for the show.
Do you want to spank everyone now?
No, I don't want to spank anyone. I tried to think of, like, what circumstances I would want to spank anyone who might be a fan of the show, and I just can't think of it.
Only if they're George Michael.
Speaking of George Michael, let's talk about abstinence. there's been a popular movement in this country for the past maybe half decade or maybe a little more, where they're trying to use ways of, in public schools, we teach children how to safely protect against sex. One of the core curricula of that is showing children who are of age to reproduce the basic tools that you can use to make sure that you're safe and that your partner is safe. And among those tools was always abstinence. And it's not like it was ever tucked away. It was always shown up. It would always show up as saying, here's all the tools that we will teach you about. But remember, abstinence is the only 100% effective tool. That's how it was always wrapped up for me. And I'm sure it's the same way with most people we know, at least here in Michigan. So I don't know what other people's experiences were like, but that was mine. And now there's this sudden movement to push for these abstinence-only programs, and the Bush administration, of course, is on board with this. In fact, they're giving funding for this. The federal government, in 2005, spent approximately $100 million on abstinence-only education, which means that they cut out the portion that states all the facts about condoms or any other contraceptives, but instead replaces that with false information about condoms and contraceptives, and then says, and because of those frightening circumstances, that's why abstinence is what you should be choosing. So what brought this to my attention, actually my girlfriend sent this to me, it was a report written, or was prepared for Representative Henry Waxman, who's actually from Los Angeles, California. And this was back in December of 2004. The name of the document was The Content of Federally Funded Abstinence-Only Education Programs. And in this document, it basically outlines all the fallacies that are being taught under this mandated program in public schools. And basically, it also evaluates it evaluates the content of the literature that is being given to students. Some really intriguing things that are being said, not only about contraceptives and safety measures that can be taken, but also about gender roles within America and how the abstinence-only part, you know, this culture of people who promote this abstinence-only education programs, how they view women, especially in the framework of society, which is, you know, they are always pre-pregnant, if I can use a more current term, you know, where they're just lying in wait to get pregnant, and how they should be there to, you know, satisfy a man, and a man should be there to provide for a woman. Very archaic, very cult of domesticity roles for women. So anyway, so there's some really information, and Tanner, I had sent this link to you, so I hope you had a chance to kind of go over it. But there's a few key things that they came up with, and here's just some of the highlights in the prologue to it, but it says that abstinence-only curriculum false information about the effectiveness of contraceptives. An example of this is that they put in their curriculum that, quote, the popular claim that condoms help prevent the spread of STDs is not supported by the data, which is wrong. Another quote was that in heterosexual sex, condoms fail to prevent HIV approximately 31% of the time, which I've never heard that inflated figure ever in my life. Another bullet point was that abstinence-only curricula contains false information about risks of abortion. This is really crucial considering right now we're in a very, you know, heavy Roe v. Wade. We don't know which way it's going to go with the Supreme Court now. But one of the curriculum, as this document states, it says that 5 to 10% of women who have legal abortions will become sterile. That's absolutely false. That premature birth, a major cause of mental retardation, is increased following the abortion of a first pregnancy. So basically saying if you abort your first baby, you better rest assured that your second baby is going to be fucked up, which fucked up rhetoric to give to young women. And then another one is that tubal and cervical pregnancies are increased following abortions. And, of course, as this document points out, these risks don't increase at all after procedures. In fact, how they will increase, if I may interject my own opinion, will be if we have back alley procedures, which will certainly happen if we outlawed abortion. If there were back alley procedures where there was no sterile tools being used and doctors who are unlicensed, that's when these risks will increase. So that's why having a pro-abortion government at this point is crucial, because we can ensure at least the safety risks that come with abortion are not they are not made into something worse than they are. So anyway, Tanner, you had a few things within this document, and there was also a couple things that you had sent that were kind of tangential to the document regarding literature that about their children that mothers and fathers can get. Tell me a few of the interesting things. There's a few things, especially regarding pornography and ways to talk to your child that you had brought up to me last night. Just maybe if you told some of the listeners what you had found. It was very interesting.
Yeah, I was interested in the report, and then because it seemed so ridiculous, you know, I wanted to check the facts on it. So I went to Wait, as in WAIT, training.com, which was one of the programs they cited in this document. And I went to the parent frequently asked questions, and I was amazed at the idiocy that was in the frequently asked questions. And some of the greatest hits were, you know, to answer the question, what should I know about the teen brain? One of the parts was that teens cannot wrap their concrete brains around abstract concepts, which is entirely, I mean, obviously false that teens can't understand abstract concepts. It's a ridiculous assertion. And then, of course, they demonize pornography and masturbation. And pornography, they say, what is it here? That there is research, of course they don't cite this research, that viewing pornography actually decreases your ability to be a good lover and consequently decreases your enjoyment of sex. False.
Yeah.
And then masturbation, which this blows my mind that people are still against masturbation, but they say that it creates someone who becomes a very selfish lover, being focused on their own pleasure. I mean, this is it's 2006, and this stuff is still being deployed.
And one thing to be stated too is in regards to the content distributed nationwide, it does vary region to region. I'm not saying that there is this rigid one-size-fits policy for all communities. In fact, where you'll find the most strict curricula being taught is in where you would expect in the of Kansas or these typical red states. And of course, the out you go, if you go to New York City or Los Angeles or I'm sure Seattle or any other progressive city, this type of stuff won't be as prevalent as it is in these more rural or more conservative areas. But it's interesting because it just shows you the agenda of this administration. They're giving this money to there's this program called Special Programs of Regional and National Significance, which is they do community-based abstinence education. It's called SPRANS is the acronym for it. But they're the largest abstinence-only education provider, and they get money from the federal government that. And so, and what's so interesting about this is that the federal government really doesn't have any oversight in the content of what's being published. In fact, they just kind of give them money and say, go on now, you guys go do your work, you know, spread the word about abstinence nationwide, which is ridiculous to me, because there needs to be, of course, if we were somehow able to monitor this curricula, then we would hopefully have some legitimate claim with Democrats who are in office who are saying, look, this is wrong. And thankfully, Henry Waxman did bring this up. And unfortunately, though, this, I don't know how many other people know about this specific publication that came out in regards to this, but so anyway, I guess some of the major things about this, let me just find them here. Under these programs, they're not allowed to teach any of the students about how to reduce the risk of pregnancy. All they're allowed to do is teach about how to abstain, which is easy. You just say no, right? I mean, it's a simple thing as that. Which means that students nationwide are missing out on a core feature of sex prevention, which is basically learning what contraceptives are, how they work, if you're going to, you know, how best to use them. I guess I'm not sure I understand the other side's argument, which is always teaching how to use contraceptives promotes the use of contraceptives. I've never quite bought into that, because the use of contraceptives comes when a teen feels they're ready to use them at some point, and those who don't are usually the dumbasses in the first place, and they're always going to be experimenting. Those kids are always going to end up fucking somebody, and in turn, you know, having a child, or maybe aborting a child, and I understand people are sensitive to that. But at the same time, we're not doing anyone a favor by just teaching abstinence. I don't know, Tanner, give me some of your thoughts while I try to draw up some data here.
What I'm interested in is what the great goal of abstinence education is. And on one hand, you know, it makes me angered just because it is so illogical, because people are going to have sex regardless. But on another end, if you look at sort of Foucault's major, you know, one of his major focuses of his work, and he's considered probably the greatest 20th century philosopher, is his concept of biopower, wherein through sex, you know, political forces can sort of enact power over a population, and this obviously has a lot to do with class and racial division. And through sort of abstinence programs, what they're trying to do is, through sex, sort of make ultimate capital consumers, in that you can only have sex when you're part of the economic system. And until then, there's no sex, there's no pleasure. It's all about waiting until you're part of the system, and then you can produce. But it's also got a component of sort of racism, in that they want, through using abstinence education, which is not going to be as effective. I know in like California, where you have a cultural collision between sort of the Latino culture, which is very family focused, not from the same sort of economic situation, where they don't understand the American thing, where you wait to have kids until you're set up, you know, and have a good job and are producing and are a cog in the system. So they have kids earlier because that's what they like. They like to have big families, like to have kids earlier. By pushing abstinence education rather than, you know, STD prevention and stuff like that, you get both bonuses. You keep a permanent underclass by teaching a program that is not going to prevent pregnancy, and also teaching a program that's not going to prevent STDs. You know, they aren't adapting certain programs to different cultures, the underclass cultures that have different sex and family practices. So you're sort of getting it both ways by teaching an abstinence education. You're enabling a permanent underclass by not educating them about sex, and then also, you know, keeping white people in terms of the capital producers by teaching them to wait and wait and wait until they've all got jobs, you know, and are working, and then not even give them benefits for pregnancy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like the ultimate sort of fuck-over situation. Rather than teaching people about how to prevent pregnancy, how to be responsible when you do, you know, pick a responsible time in your life, you know, and that sort of thing.
And there's all these fallacies within the teaching. And what they did in this, like I said, they took literature that's passed out to students. Some of it's called, like, Me, My World, and My Future, you know, that kind of bullshit. And here's a few of the things that they try to do within the curriculum, though. And this is, I'll just read it straight from the report. One curriculum draws an analogy between the HIV virus and a penny and compares it to a sperm cell. In sperm is the name of this this illustration, I guess, of this show, which on the same scale would be almost 19 feet long. So by comparison, what they try to do is they try to make a sperm cell be about 19 feet long. The curriculum asks, if the condom has a failure rate of 14% for preventing Speedy from getting through to create a new life, what happens if this guy, the penny, gets through? You have a death, your own. Another curriculum inaccurately attacks a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that demonstrated that condoms are effective in preventing HIV transmission, something we all know. And the New England Journal of Medicine is very credible, you know, research group. In the study, there was not a single case of HIV transmission between HIV-positive individuals and their HIV-negative partners using condoms consistently, despite a total of 15,000 acts of intercourse. The curriculum, however, states, this study has been criticized by three different university groups as being seriously flawed in at least six areas, and therefore the results are questionable and not statistically significant. In fact, the university groups referred to in the curriculum individuals who sent letters to the editor of the journal in which the study appeared. So what they did was they took letters to the editor. This is like going to your local newspaper sound-off section, and it might say, Chris View, you know, I went to Oakland University, so it might say Oakland University underneath, and then stating that Oakland University is in, you know, has a major difference with the New England Journal of Medicine. I mean, it's just bullshit to do. Hey, I'm getting a phone call I gotta take. You keep talking about this. I'll be back in just a second.
Yeah, I would just like to back on the Foucault subject, because, you know, I have to say that I love Foucault. I guess people have to... You have to look at this from the section of how does abstinence education fit into networks of power? How is this working for power? Not only how is it absolutely retarded, which we all know, but how is it functioning for power, working for power, and serving the ends of power? And I think in the main way, abstinence education is keeping a permanent underclass, because they know they're not dealing with cultural difference, and that underclass is still going to have babies, and that they can also make white people and people and Asians and people of, you know, greater economic status in this country wait and produce, and then get stuck in this quagmire of having very few babies, keeping the population under control, and also being part of the capitalist system. Instead of, you know, I know there's a lot of people out there that want to have kids earlier, but just simply can't because of how fucked over everyone is in this system where you have to have two-parent households and that sort of thing. So that's just what I would say, is that you need to look at this from the situation of power and why this is working towards certain biopolitical ends, which it absolutely is.
Most certainly it is. And you're bringing up a lot of things regarding race and ethnicity, but also, you know, gender roles, which we've talked about, and I said we would bring up in the beginning of the podcast. This intrigues me to include gender roles in such a way in sex education talk, because what other thing is there between a man and woman except for, you know, in this type of sexual education environment, except for to say the two come together to copulate, and here's how to prevent, you know, any incidents from happening. But what the curriculum goes on to do is it takes women and objectifies them. It takes them back to some archaic. It boils them down to basically the people men impregnate, and then they carry the seed, and they have to ensure that they make sure that the men still stay happy. So let me just read to you also some of the findings in the study, and it's that stereotypes that it's under a section that says stereotypes that undermine girls' achievement. One curriculum instructs, quote, women gauge their happiness and judge their success by their relationships. Men's happiness and success hinge on their accomplishments. I mean, where do they get this information from? How did they come up with that? The other thing states, men tend to be more today and what needs to be done for a secure future. When women began to enter the workforce at an equal pace with men, companies noticed that women were not as concerned about preparing for retirement. This stems from the priority men and women place on the past, present, and future. So what it's saying is that women have not, like, they haven't evolved just recently into the workforce. They don't understand complex things like preparing for retirement. They need their hand held with all these things. All these studies have shown that women are not capable. And that's bullshit. I've never heard such bullshit rhetoric in my life. Another curriculum. It lists financial support as one of the five major needs of women and domestic support as one of the five major needs of men. I'm reading this verbatim again. The curriculum states, quote, just as a woman needs to feel a man's devotion to her, a man has a primary need to feel a woman's admiration. To admire a man is to regard him with wonder, delight, and approval. A man feels admired when his unique characteristics and talents happily amaze her. I don't... This is the same kind of bullshit that... I went to two weddings this summer, and both weddings, there was this weird statement that came up where it basically told the woman she was being passed off from one man to another, her father to her husband, and that, you know, basically like a piece of property, and that she was there to obey and honor her husband, and that her husband was basically there to provide for her needs. And it's, again, it's this weird ass that I don't understand what's going on in people's minds still today where they think that women are somehow not on par with men. But this is in sex education talk where you're saying that women should try to appeal to a man's wonder, delight, and approval, that they should admire him, that they should be amazed by his talents and shit like that. No, it's bullshit. I can't even imagine that. Here's another thing. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here, but the curriculum is, quote, the father gives the bride to the groom because he is the one man who has had the responsibility of protecting her throughout her life. He is now giving his daughter to the only other man who will take over this protective role. Girl who... Okay, I don't... Most girls who I know who are progressive, like your girlfriend and mine especially, don't need our, quote, protection. We need to give them our umbrella of, you know, manly strength to let them go on with their lives. I just don't understand... This is the most ridiculous gender discrimination I've ever seen in my life, and it's being mandated by our government through tax dollars, which are given to the Sprans company that goes through and distributes sex education literature.
Yeah, and
I mean, people should be fucking outraged.
I can't encourage people enough, especially women, in terms of marriage, to critique the vows they're going to be taking.
Yeah,
get a copy of what they're going to say and edit them. Because it's ridiculous, you know, what the vows that most people take, especially under religious ceremonies, particularly under Catholic ceremonies, The vows are absolutely antiquated, ridiculous, and it's like a slap in the face.
It's more antiquated now under the non-denominational or Protestant sects. I have to say it. I mean, you know, yeah, Catholic, they have, see, Catholics have, like, this script, whereas these non-denominational sects, they each have their own separate interpretation, and each one is more strange than the next.
Yeah.
So you know what you're getting out of a Catholic ceremony, but when it comes to these non-denominational ones, you get some of the most far-fetched, far-out ideas about how a woman is supposed to be in relation to a man, and it's despicable to even see that.
For walking down the aisle, why not have the mother and father present? Why not have anyone you choose present? I mean,
sure.
Break the fucking tradition. Screw things up. Be subversive. Please, people! Please!
My girlfriend brought up a really good point last night when we were discussing this, and it was that she said when she gets married that she will have both her mom and dad walk her down the aisle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Halfway down the aisle, they're going to go sit down, and because no one is giving her away to anyone. It's a conscious decision she, as an adult, made to marry whoever the man is, and she is not going to have some symbol of her being given away because she's, you know, her family raised her for half her life or so, and now she's going to walk down the aisle herself the other half of the way if you want symbolism. So, I mean, and I think that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason to be given away. But here's another interesting thing before we get off this topic. The same curriculum tells participants, this is hilarious, while a man needs little or no preparation for sex, a woman often needs hours of emotional and mental preparation. What the fuck does that mean? Like, I do not understand that. My experience with women, I know my mom and dad are listening right now, but whatever. My experience with women is that they do not need hours and hours of emotional and mental preparation. There's a lot of times where they're just as ready as anybody. Yeah, I don't understand this concept of, like, a woman needing to be somehow worked up into horny too. I don't understand why people don't acknowledge that.
And you know where the whole abstinence thing really comes from? And it comes from the idea of a man needing a virgin, unspoiled woman. That's where whole abstinence thing comes from. It's really not about guys being abstinent. Let's be real here. It's about women being abstinent and having a pure, unspoiled woman. It's that's truly the roots of these types of programs, because they all reinforce that old ass idea of like a man taking a woman, and she damn well better be pure and unspoiled and not oversexed. You know?
Exactly. I mean, and underlying all of this information are a few key things that promote your idea. Number one is that all of the lecherous things that you could be doing if you weren't abstaining will create some sort of tainted baby in the future. It will create some sort of unhealthiness. Mm-hmm. So they want to make sure that you're unhealthy. They also want to teach a man, and of course those go back to, you know, how does a man who is getting his unspoiled virgin, you know, how should she be presenting herself as, you know, this chaste woman? And all these other, like, these things that are ingrained, that are unnecessarily being, you know, taught to these children. Because sex education should be very, I mean, how do I put this? I don't want to say it should be asexual, because that doesn't make sense, but it should have nothing to do with, you know, what your gender is. It should just be that if you, as a woman, choose to fuck, here's what's available to you and how to use it. If you, as a man, choose to fuck, here's what's available. If both of you come together and you fuck up, then here's what's available to you. End of story. You now know all of your options. You're an educated human being. That's where it should stand.
Well, I mean, you can't even really define things by man and woman anymore. I mean, the sex has been blurred so much. I mean, to call something homosexual, heterosexual, all that sort of thing, it's all been, at least in sort of the theory nowadays, all those categories have sort of been eroded. And I see a lot of these programs as sort of fighting the last throes of that battle where those categories are still placed. I mean, sex as an act has been exploded, and I think a lot of people are starting to realize now it's incredibly hard to define some people's sexuality, which it should be, because it's just, you know, it's sort of ephemeral. It's just whatever anybody chooses, you know.
Yeah.
And these programs are all trying to establish, this is the family, it's a man and a woman, this is good, this is bad, and it's just, it's all really sad, because, you know, hopefully in 100 years, all that stuff will seem incredibly antiquated. I mean, to me it already does, but hopefully to everyone else it will soon.
To wrap this all up, the rumor has it, and this hasn't been confirmed yet, I'm still waiting for more sources to come in, but so far a few of them are checking out, but rumor has it of the Croc Hunter were, "I only wish I could have saw HPV eradicated." That was his last words, and unfortunately he died before HPV could have been eradicated. It's really sad to say. You have just recently embarked on this incredible journey to become a guitar hero. Tell us about it.
Oh, it's already been 40 minutes. Okay, we'll save Guitar Hero for the next podcast, but I've got a point to make about Dance Dance.
Okay.
That is really quick. And this is something that I'm just sort of interested and intrigued by, and it was mainly started from being in a guild on World of Warcraft with a lot of mega nerds. I consider myself a geek, but not a nerd. And there's a
huge difference.
There's a huge difference. Geeks are sort of into sort of pop culture, geeky sort of things, comics, movies, video games, that sort of thing. Nerds are just like overboard, social outcast type people, which is there's nothing wrong with that. They rule. But I was in this guild with a bunch of nerds, and there was one thing I noticed that I've always noticed throughout my life, but then I just started really thinking about how awesome it is. How nerds, due to being social outcasts, I don't know if it's from their upbringing, from being outcast from normal society, they have a different standard of cool. I mean, everyone in basically the inner circle of society, which is, I would say, 95% of people, everyone is exposed to the same media, gets fed the same idea of what's cool and what's not. And we either follow it or we don't, but we sort of understand what's cool or what's not. I'm sort of interested in how nerds completely don't understand it and then redefine to them what's cool. And this was brought up to me when I heard over TeamSpeak, which is a voice chat sort of thing, and the in-chat client.
Nerd!
People discussing how, like, certain people's pictures on this website were cool because they were wearing trench coats or, like, crazy, like, Indiana Jones hats and shit. And I was thinking how uncool they looked. But in the nerd psyche, when you're only exposed to anime and video games, people wear that type of shit. They wear trench coats, they wear big-ass fedoras and carry swords and shit. And to them, that's the coolest thing ever, because those are their definers of cool. And I was thinking, like, how fascinating that is, that there's two different standards of cool. And it all came to a head when I started watching Dance Dance Revolution videos and hearing people talk about Dance Dance Revolution, which is an arcade game where you dance on, like, a pad with different buttons on it. And there's people who truly believe that they're awesome and look cool when they are on Dance Dance Revolution. And I encourage anyone to go on YouTube, look up Dance Dance Revolution, and watch somebody play that. And they look they look beyond ridiculous when they're playing this game. I mean, it's just a whole another level of nerddom. To get on a Dance Dance Revolution pad and flail your feet around like a moron. I mean, you look so uncool by normal society standards, but I really think in the nerd community, in their mind, they look cool. They're a good dancer, they're skilled at something, so they look cool. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that? That in the nerd mind, when they're on a Dance Dance Revolution pad, they are cool.
Yes, I agree with it. I guess, and this is something you and I talked about too, but for me there's a blending of two different types of cool here, and I guess I need to do more research. Okay, let me preface this by saying I have friends who do Dance Dance Revolution, and they're good at it. They're good. But the difference isn't good while they're doing it. So there's this interesting dichotomy of interest here. Okay, what's cooler? Is it cooler to have a high score and look like shit, or cooler to have a low score and look awesome while getting that low score? It's the ultimate blending in video games, because think of yourself playing any other video game. When I'm sitting at my computer desk playing World of Warcraft, I do not look cool. Okay? When I'm in my living room on a couch with a controller, I don't look cool. If I'm playing with my Nintendo Power Glove, I look awesome. Okay? If I'm on a Dance Dance Revolution, you can look like you know how to dance.
No, you can't!
See the video of those Asian kids who look like they know how to dance and they're doing tandem stuff?
I've never seen anyone who looks like they can dance.
Search YouTube and look for those people who do it. I mean, serious, and they get high scores and they look like they can dance.
When Justin Timberlake is on the VMAs doing a dance, he looks completely different. He is, you know, he's the standard of cool in dancing. And then you go to Dance Dance Revolution. It's a totally different thing where your upper body is stiff and you're just flailing your feet around, touching buttons. You don't there's not aesthetic interest in making somebody's feet look cool when they're touching the pads.
That's not true. I've seen really good people at it. In fact, I'm watching a video right now. And of course, the guy's Asian, because most of these are, I mean, a lot of these are in Asia, these ports that they have. This guy is, like, doing all these mad things. He's not doing your normal dance. He's not flailing his arms. He's dancing with his arms while doing amazing kicks. He's doing the running man right now. he looks really good.
I can't believe. Okay, I'm going to watch this guy right now.
Women cheering. Here, I'm going to send you my link.
See, I really think this doesn't look cool.
He doesn't look bad, and it's blending the fact that he's good at a game and he can dance. This kid's not dancing like an idiot. He's dancing like you would see someone in a club.
Okay, he just pounded on the floor. He's getting himself pumped.
Because there's obviously those kids who... All right, I'm going to say it right now. He's a good friend of ours, but Jason Koss, I know you're listening right now. You're a master at Dance Dance, but It's not like you look like you can dance, it's that you hit the buttons perfectly, and that's what's so great about it. That's a real gamer playing Dance Dance. Now, these other people that... If you click that link that I just went to, did you click that yet?
Yeah, see, here's the difference. This guy, he's hitting the buttons, but he's putting some flair into it.
Exactly, that's what I'm talking about. That's why Dance Dance can be both things. And he hit them. I mean, he did them all right. So he just used the game to its ultimate capacity. It wasn't just a workout for him, Dance Dance. It wasn't just, you know, him playing a video game to get a high score. It was him getting a high score while looking sweet.
See, but I think most nerds, when they go to play it, they're touching buttons, looking stupid as hell. But in their minds, they're a good dancer. I know when I play Guitar Hero... You know, I was never very good at the guitar, but when you play Guitar Hero, you sort of get in this trance where you're thinking like, wow, I'm rocking out. You get in this delusion where you look cool, but you totally don't. You look ridiculous. But I love that nerds can't make that, they can't distinguish between those two worlds.
Well, one thing that Guitar Hero does that DDR does not do is... And this might help you in thinking you look way cooler. Like with DDR, you're just seeing blocks go down a screen and you're hitting them. Whereas with Guitar Hero, you're able to see the character you've created play guitar, the audience's reaction. There's a lot of interaction that's not in Dance Dance, at least in the earlier version. They've upped it since then, I'm not sure. But there's a lot more flair going on with Guitar Hero where you can look like you really know how to. Or in your gamer mind, you're transplanted into the body of this this digital person who is rocking out on stage. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that helps with the illusion a lot more.
Yeah, and I think they did a good job of recreating sort of what guitar playing is like.
Sure, if you fuck up too much, that's exactly what it's like. People boo you, they want to kill you. That's the life on the road, dude.
All right, we gotta end this though.
All right. Next week, then, we'll talk more about Guitar Hero and DDR. Maybe we'll have a special guest next week. Again, I'm still getting reports coming in about Steve Irwin, and now his last words have been revamped. It's saying now that his new last words, his second to last words were about HPV. His new last words were something to the effect of, I only wish I could have been a special guest on this just happier than Christ for my children. I think next week in his honor, maybe we should bring out a special guest and appease the masses for him. So next week, look for a special guest. Maybe we'll bring someone out of the woodwork. We got a ton of famous people who love this show. So anyway, till then, that's it for me.
You've been listening to This Just In, recorded and distributed on Monday, September 4th, 2006. For more information about this podcast, as well as other projects, please visit www.the-means.com.